Okay, we are just past the 7:30, so I think we'll go ahead and get started. So welcome all. Welcome to get any guests with us tonight. As always, we welcome guests at the Auto PC User Group. If you want to join, we'd love to have you join us, but don't feel you have to. I did paste into the chat a link where you can join, or you can just go to our website and click on the link to join or renew. And just a reminder that we will be, let me just mute all right now. I'm muting all, and you do have the ability to unmute yourself. Please feel free to do so if you have a comment or a question, and remute yourself afterwards so we keep background noise to minimum. Later on this evening, the contents of the deck, the contents of the chat, and the audio track will go up on our website. So feel free to grab that to review any of the material you see tonight. And with that, I will turn it over to Alan to take us through tonight's deck.
Okay, thanks, Chris. And we'll get started with a special offer. Linda is going to be doing what she calls an armchair travel presentation on some trips that she made to British Columbia. So if you're interested, it's on Tuesday, January 23rd at 7 p.m. There's the Zoom link. And if you need more information, there's Linda's email address. She'll be happy to chat to you. Go on.
If I could just add that I'm not going to be showing any pictures of snowy mountains. So for those who want a bit of color, it's going to be a lot of gardens and seaside and birds and things like that, just to warn you.
So, okay, thanks, Linda. Okay, so next up, we have a YouTube tech item. I've been looking at a few YouTube videos recently, and I mentioned one last week, I think, on or a week before, on the supercomputers. I found a couple of videos on Unix, and this one's called The Story of Unix, and it's really quite interesting. It tells you how Unix came out of Bell Labs, and then it goes through what they call the Unix Wars, when everybody and his brother decided to create a flavor of Unix, and everybody was trying to make money out of it, and ending up with, more recently, certain versions of Unix are still available, but the spin-off was the rise of Linux. So all of the above is in a couple of videos. This one called the rise of Unix. And then the second one in the series is called The Unix Wars. So the two URLs are there. If you're interested in Unix and Linux, it's really quite interesting to actually watch these things and see how everything evolved from first beginnings. Okay, next up we have a share from Chris.
Yeah, so Windows 11, they have a new sort of a feature update, but Microsoft now calls them moments. So these are when they bundle together a bunch of new things, new capabilities into Windows, and they come out with these moments. They don't really announce them that way, so you never actually see things the way you do with 23H2 and things like that. But at any rate, we've got a new feature update called Moment 5 coming up. And so there's a bunch of new things that are available in it, such as the ability to remove news from the widgets. I don't use the widgets at all. I've disabled them, so that wasn't of interest to me. Ability to remove Bing from the Windows search pane. That's sort of interesting to some people who want to use their preferred search engine. More apps are going to be uninstallable, which is always nice. So apparently Edge, you can actually remove from Windows, and Cortana, camera, and photos. There are going to be some improvements to Copilot, and so it can be undocked from the toolbar, and it will show up in your Alt Tab menu where you cycle through open applications, and it'll have multi-monitor support and some other things like that. And they say some improvements to built-in apps, and not a lot of details about that. And there are some more things, and I pasted the URL into the chat on some details from Windows Central on what to expect in Moment 5. That's it.
Okay, Chris, the next one's yours too.
Yeah, okay, so this was an interesting one. It came in from Harvey Hope And let me just get something I'm going to paste in the knowledge. Okay, so he was having a problem where he was using Zoom desktop client, and while his webcam used to work fine, all of a sudden it wouldn't work. He couldn't enable it. And so the toolbar icon for it would have a line through it. Clicking on it didn't enable the video. He tried multiple video cameras. He did some testing with me. I tried doing the host requesting to turn on video, and that didn't work. So nothing really was working in order to get things working on the webcam. So interestingly, he found that the video worked fine when he was hosting a Zoom meeting rather than joining an existing Zoom meeting. And another thing that was really interesting is if you go into the settings, you can actually preview your video in the settings dialog box, and his video showed up there fine. So it was very curious that it just wasn't broadcasting the video. Next. So what turned out to fix it was he had to actually completely remove the Zoom client, and Zoom actually has a utility designed to completely remove everything. And he says it didn't actually remove everything because a lot of the settings he had from before were there, but he did use that rather than just the add remove install capability built into Windows. And he reinstalled Zoom desktop client, next, and lo and behold, his video is working. So if anybody has similar problems, that might be what you do. It's pretty fast and easy fix to just uninstall the Zoom client and reinstall it. And I don't know if Harvey's on the call tonight. Just look. Yeah, Harvey's there. Video's still working for you there, Harvey?
Yes, it is. I really like my hair in this picture, though.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks for your help, Chris.
Yeah, not a problem.
Okay, thanks, Chris. Okay, so a couple of weeks ago, I was talking about the benefits of having a dedicated data partition. And there were a couple of questions in the chat window, which I said I would follow up on. And the first one was from Tom, and he says, how do you move partitions? Because if you clone a drive to a larger hard drive, it's useful to be able to move partitions around. And I guess especially if the recovery partition ends up next to the system drive, and you've got lots of unallocated space to the right, you won't be able to expand the system drive until you've moved the recovery partition. Anyway, in more general terms, partitions, if you buy a Windows computer, you'll probably end up with a partition scheme that looks a bit like this. This is a GPT partition type scheme. You got the system partition on the left, which is sometimes called EFI or boot. This is the UP boot partition. And then there might be an MSR, a Microsoft System Recovery partition. And then the main partition is labeled Windows. That's your main C drive. And then right at the end will be a recovery partition, which will be Windows RE, which is where all the tools are. If your system won't boot and you try and run a Windows repair, then it goes and looks for software in that recovery environment partition. So those are the kind of things you normally end up with. And if you look in disk management, as I said, if you had extra space on the right-hand edge of this partition, you wouldn't be able to expand the Windows partition, which in this case is drive E, because the recovery partition's on up against it, right adjacent to the Windows partition. And so there's nowhere for the Windows partition to go. So what you'd like to do is basically slide the recovery partition all the way to the right, and then you could resize this partition. Well, if you had extra space, you could move it to the right, and then you'd have unallocated space. But in this case, if you want to create another partition, what you have to do is basically shrink something. So here you've got almost a terabyte, 930 gigabytes of disk space. So we can shrink that a bit to create some allocated space, and then we could drop another partition in there, or we could move this partition over to the left. Except that while we can shrink the partition and expand the partition using the disk management utility, that doesn't allow us to move the partition. So if you really want to move a partition, then Microsoft isn't any good to you, and you need a third party product to do that. And there's all kinds of them out there. And the one I took a look at is Aomi. They have a disk imaging product called Backupper. And this is another free software, their partition assistant. And you can see on this particular drive, we've got the main Windows system drive is here. There's some unallocated space or a data drive right there. There's some unallocated space in this position right here. And here's probably the recovery partition. Right, so that's a primary partition too. But anyway, let's say we want to move this partition. So we can use this option to either resize or move. So we could apply that to drive E here and make shrink drive E, make it smaller. But we can also, because we've got unallocated space here, we can move this guy over to the left by using this resize utility. So when you click on that, you get this option here where you can see the available space, and you can drag these handles, or actually just drag and drop, just get hold of this guy and drag him all the way to the left and drop him in the end here. So to move the partition, you need some kind of software which will allow you to do that, some kind of partition assistant like the Aomi product. Another really interesting question came in from Serge Leek, who said when he looks at his laptop, he's got just over 1 gigabyte as an NTFS, or Microsoft File System Recovery Partition, which is 95% full. How do I know which application created it? Good question. Should I enlarge it manually, or will the program that created it enlarge it on its own and tell me when it's at capacity? And this turned out to be more than you ever wanted to know about recovery partitions, and I still don't know everything type of question. I think the answer is, I can tell you what it is anyway. I don't think you should enlarge it manually. Recovery partitions are either created by Microsoft themselves or by the OEM who made your computer. They created them, they made them whatever size they are, and if it needs changing, then I suspect they should be the ones to do it, which we'll come back to in a minute. However, here's Serge Eric's disk manage, or the equivalent of the disk management program. This is a partition expert program. And you can see over here is this 1 gigabyte NTFS partition that doesn't really say anything other than NTFS. And if you look in the list here, again, it doesn't have any description, but it says it's a recovery partition here. So there are basically, as I said, there are basically two types of recovery partitions. There's the Windows RE partition, which is when you have a problem and you go into the troubleshooting part of Windows, it gives you the option to do like startup repair or startup settings and change a whole bunch of different things. And some of these tools here are in this Windows RE partition. The other one is called an OEM recovery partition. So it's basically a version of a recovery partition which is created by the computer manufacturer. And I'm not sure how you actually get this thing to work. Presumably, if something blows up, you can do a factory reset, but how you actually do it, I'm not quite sure. And to be quite honest, I don't really care. And the reason is, Here's my hard drive. And you can see on my hard drive, this truly is a GPT partition scheme. It's got multiple partitions and a whole bunch of recovery ones. Now, personally, I don't use recovery partitions because I basically make a full disk image backup every month. And if something blows up, I basically just recover the disk or one of the partitions, whatever's needed. I can do an update on the Windows update, and then I'm back in business without having to mess around with recovery partitions. However, Microsoft has a utility program which is called Reagency, and it basically will look at the partition scheme. And so if you use this command in a command window, reagency/info, then it will tell you that the Windows recovery environment, this Windows RE partition, is on disk zero, says hard disk zero. It's on partition number 6 in the recovery partition, and it's a Windows RE partition. So if you look at that, then you know that this Windows RE is the Microsoft Windows recovery environment partition. So at least that tells you what the partition is. And here you can see here's partition scheme number 6. Right here, you can see that it's a recovery partition and it's 500/600 meg. And here's the partition scheme with basically numbers. If you look here, I've got numbers 1, 2, 4, 6, 8, 9, and 10. You notice that there's no 3, 5, and 7. So the question is, what are those and where are they? But before we do that, just point out, Chris made the note that if you're going to play around with partitions, and if you're going to extend them or shrink them or whatever you're going to do with them, make sure that you're pointing at the right partition. Because although I'm talking about these 10 partitions on disk zero, you will note up here that it's actually drive S, which is highlighted. So anything I do is going to be on drive S. And drive S is this 64 gig SD card down here. Anyway, we're actually looking at disk zero and all these different partitions. So let's use another Windows command, disk partition, the disk part command. So if we do that, we run disk part in the command window. Now we can enter disk part type commands. And one of them is just list disk. So you list the disk and it tells me that I have a disk zero, which is 230 gig, and a disk one, which is 64 gig. So this is my 250 gig SSD, and this is my 64 gig SD card. So clearly I'm interested in looking at the partitions on disk zero. So what I want to do now is I want to select disk zero and then list the partitions. So again, I have to enter these commands. Select disk zero, list the partitions, and then here it's listing all the partitions. And now you can see that here's partition number 3, which is reserved. It's 128 meg. And partition 5 is primary. And partition 7 is primary. And if we look at these things, partition 3, which didn't show up in disk management, is a Microsoft reserved hidden partition. It doesn't even show up in the disk management utility. What it's for, I've got no idea, but Mr. Microsoft knows very well what he's going to do with it. Partition number 5 is labeled as primary. It's 140 gig. That is my Windows C drive, the main drive. And partition 7, which wasn't numbered but was listed as primary, is a 16 gig partition, which is my dedicated data partition, which if partition 5 shows up as drive C, then partition 7 shows up as drive D under Windows. And there we are. So 5 wasn't showing here, but actually it's that this is partition 5 down here, the Windows 10 C drive, and this is partition 7, the Windows data disk D drive. So by playing around with these kind of things, you can pretty well figure out what the partitions are and where they came from. And here's the Windows recovery partition, Windows RE, partition 6. So now the question is, what are all these other partitions? Well, here's the OEM one, so that's going to be a factory type one, I guess, although it's fairly small. But then there's one here, which is, 2 terabytes recovery, 2 gigabytes rather, recovery. There's a 500 gig one here, there's an 11 gig one here. What on earth are all these things? As I said, I'm personally not going to use them, so I'm not terribly concerned. I could probably delete them and it wouldn't affect things. I'd actually gain some space, I guess. But this one's kind of interesting. This is partition number 8, that 11 gigabyte one. And if I go into that this part command and I do a detail on the partition, then it tells me it's a hidden partition and it gives me this long string of alphanumeric numbers. And in the Windows 7 days, the type would be a number. And let's say in Windows 7, this could have been a type 12 partition, which would have been hidden. But if I change that using this part command to a type 7, then it would have showed up in disk management and as a drive with a letter, and I could actually see what's in that partition. That's much more difficult these days. I think you have to look at what's in a recovery partition like that, you have to A, hack the registry, which is more than I want to do for recovery partitions, and B, you have to get rid of the odd ini file, which stops things being displayed. But I found some information on YouTube on how to do this, and this is a screenshot from the video, and you can see that he's pulled up a partition here, which is showing up as drive F now. And you can see it's got a boot partition, a UP partition, and a factory process, clearly some kind of factory recovery type partition. And then there's a whole bunch of files and folders, which are used to do that factory reset type process. So, as I say, that's more than you ever wanted to know about recovery partitions. But if you really do want to know more, here are the two things I found on YouTube. This is talking about talking about the Windows RE partition, and this one is talking about the OEM factory image partition, and that tells you how to use reagent C and how to hack the registry and how to do all kinds of weird and wonderful things if that's what you want to do. And all I say is good luck. Okay, moving along. Moving along. Right, we're not done. So a question came in about a Windows update, KB and this magic number here. And Jess says that he's having an issue installing this update on 3 of 4 of his Windows 10 machines. And it generates this error code. Lots of people talking about it on the web with the same issue. And some people saying you shouldn't do anything because Microsoft are probably going to fix it or change the update or whatever. Well, I actually tried this on a couple of my machines, and one of them updated no problem. There's the same Keep KB number successfully installed. And the second one, like Jeff, failed, and I got this same error message. And when you look up on the web, and this is a Microsoft Learn type page, so this is straight from Microsoft. And what it says is it's a problem with the size of that Windows RE partition. But that's produced by Microsoft. If you remember, we don't generate WinRE partitions. So the update needs 250 megabytes free in the recovery partition. And if it doesn't have that, then it's going to fail. So clearly one of my machines had enough space and the second machine didn't have enough space. And it failed. And when it fails, then there's that magic error number. And you notice it says, to avoid this error or recover from the failure, Please follow the instructions to manually resize your partition to install the Windows RE update, and then try reinstalling the update. Good luck if you want to do that. And the alternative is this one right here, saying it's the same kind of page. Microsoft say, we're working on a resolution and we'll provide an update in an upcoming release. So personally, I'm quite happy to sit and wait for Microsoft to fix their Windows RE partition size. But if you want to dive into the registry, again, be my guest.
Alan, what is the consequence of when this update fails? Do you get constantly nagged that the update is failing, or is it just up give you once and then everything continues fine? Or
I think it just sits there in the queue, and next time you try and do an update, it runs again and fails again. And
okay,
you know, so one of these days Microsoft's going to fix things, I guess, and we'll all be in good shape. But it's only a problem on certain machines. Clearly, it depends on whether you have the right kind of Windows RE recovery partition or not.
Yeah. And
so some people see a problem and some people won't.
And presumably it doesn't affect the operation of your computer really at all, other than the ability to do a reset.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so next up is Chris with a share.
Yeah, so this is kind of interesting. It's something that I go into in some detail on my one of my library presentations I have on backup, and it's the idea of digital legacy. So if you think about it, if you are incapacitated or die, what's going to happen to all your online accounts? So you have, you know, online accounts that maybe are doing bill paying through it, you know, anything in actual fact. So your Facebook account, your email accounts and things like that. You know, what happens if you're no longer around to babysit them? Next. So you could leave details with a trusted person. So you could leave details on how they can gain access to your accounts with your passwords or whatever, and along with instructions on what you would like done with it all. So, you know, you could say, okay, this gaming account, if I die, just don't worry about it. My Facebook account, I want you to do one final posting telling everybody what I really think of them, and, you know, close out this bill paying account for, you know, Auto Hydro or whatever you want. And if you use Password Manager, which I highly recommend, this can simplify it an awful lot, because what you can do is just give them access to your Password Manager, and then along with the instructions on which what you want done with each of the accounts is listed within there. Next. Now, beyond that, though, every online service out there could have a facility on dealing with inactive accounts. And it turns out that Google actually has one called the Google Inactive Account Manager. Next. So if you go to myaccount.google.com, and if you're not signed in, it'll ask you to sign in. Actually, you'll probably be prompted to sign in regardless, because there's sensitive information in there. And then if you go to Data and Privacy, and then More Options, and you have to scroll way, way down to see the More Options. You can see the scroll bar on the right-hand side, how far we are down that page before you actually get to the More Options. And then there's an option there, Make a Plan for Your Digital Legacy. So you click on that, and you finally get to the Inactive Account Manager. And it tells you a little bit about what it's going to do, and gives you a Start button. So you click on the Start button. And then it comes up with another dialog box, and it I have to maximize this so I can see things a little better. Okay, so one of the things that it says is, well, what is inactive for you? So tell us how long before something kicks in automatically for you. And the default is 3 months of inactivity, but you can set it 3 months, 6 months, 12 months, or 18 months, and then you click on the save. Next. And they do tell you that before they take any action, They are going to try and contact you multiple times. I don't know what really that means, by either SMS or email. So those emails that are associated with your account or your phone number that you've set up with them to be able to do recovery and things like that. And you can see here I have my phone number and then I have my email address that I'm actually working on at this point here. Next. And so they, if you have additional email addresses that are set up for recovery, they will actually send to them as well. Next. And then you click the next button. Then it comes up and it asks you, okay, who do you want to notify if this account actually does go inactive for the period of time that you've specified? And after you have either ignored or you weren't around to respond to those additional notifications that they told you about that your account was inactive and this is about to kick in. So then what you do is you click on add a person, and then you put in an email address of the person you want to notify if the account goes inactive for the period of time you specified. Next. Then it says, what do you want to actually share with this person? It comes up with this long, long list. You can see it's so long that I actually had to break it into two columns. And you can go in and you can say, okay, I want this person to be able to get access, you know, information in my Google account, my Gmail, stuff that I posted to YouTube, all of the different categories of things there. And you can choose any or all of them. Well, I guess you have to do at least one, or it doesn't make sense to actually do this whole process. You go through that whole list, decide what it is you want this person to be able to have access to, and then you continue on. Next. And then you have this confirm, and when the account says when the account becomes inactive, that Google will send an email to that person, and then you can add a personal message, so long, sucka, or whatever you want, and then you click on save. Then it says that if you use Gmail, you can also set up an auto reply. So this can kick in automatically when your account becomes inactive. So you can say, no longer around, please stop emailing this account or whatever you want. Next. And next. And then it says, what do you want done to your inactive Google account itself? So do you want it to be deleted after all of this process has gone on, or do you want it to just lie around forever? And so you'll note there that they say that there will be 3 months after the account has gone inactive where your contacts can actually get in, do whatever they have to with your data and so forth, and then after that three-month period, then you can have, if you choose, you can have Google delete the account. You'll see that by default, it is not enabled. So it will not delete your Google account unless you actually move that slider over to the right. Next. Then you come up with a review plan button. Next. It just comes up with a summary of what you've chosen. So in this case here, I said my account would be considered inactive 3 months after I stopped using it, the last logon onto the account. Google will notify one of my contacts, and my inactive account will not be deleted. And then I don't know what this checkbox really means because I haven't gotten any notifications yet. It says receive email reminders that inactive account manager is turned on. I'm presuming every now and then I will get an email from Google just telling me that, hey, you've got inactive account manager turned on, so if you want to do anything about it, you know, go back in and make whatever changes. And you have the confirm plan button. Next. After that, the inactive account manager just indicates that it's set up. You will receive the inactive account manager messages periodically, and you have the option to turn off the plan if you want at that point in time. You can't actually edit the plan, but you can turn it off and then go in and re-enable it and go through all of the steps to what it is you want done with the inactive account manager. And I think that's it.
Yes, thank you very much, Chris.
I would encourage, actually, just before we move on, I would encourage anybody who knows of other services that have similar type features, if you wanted to do a share on it, on how you do it, I'm pretty sure Facebook has something like that. I don't really use Facebook. So if anybody wanted to do a share on a similar type service, that'd be really good. You know, everybody could then take a look and see whether they should be enabling these things wherever they're possible.
Can I ask a question, Chris?
Sure.
Yeah, you're saying you're going inactive instead of delete. Can I ask why?
As much as anything else, I was just playing around with the features. I don't particularly care whether my Google account stays around after I die or not. I'm a little bit paranoid about things getting accidentally deleted. And so I guess if I was incapacitated, the people I designated to look after my data and so forth didn't do anything. And then 4 months later, I'm all of a sudden I'm alive and well, and I come back and I don't want to find that, oh, my account actually got deleted. So I don't mind using Google's file space on their servers, and I don't want that to be accidentally deleted.
Okay. I was more thinking of if I die tomorrow, I want it to be deleted. But a good point. I didn't think about that. If you're just disabled for a few months and you want to reactivate. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay, thanks, Chris. Okay, so yeah, next up we have some information on a smart application for Android. And I just remind you that we're always interested in programs that people find useful for smartphones and tablets, or even for PCs, Windows programs, for example. We've had a lot of these in the past, and this one upcoming is for a battery monitoring widget for smartphones. And I don't know, Bridget, are you going to unmute your microphone and talk to this?
Yeah, I'm set.
Okay, off you go.
So yes, okay, I'm going to cut my video because my Wi-Fi is a little unstable, so I don't want to cut in and out, so I'll just do that. So, okay, so I got a Samsung phone a few years ago. And before that, I had a Motorola. And on my Motorola phone, I had a nifty little widget that showed, I don't know if you can see that, that showed the battery percentage. So I just have to tap on the phone and I could see the battery percentage in a circle. And my Samsung phone did not have this. So last summer, I started downloading all kinds of widgets for battery indicator, and I couldn't make any of them work on my lock screen, and I realized it's probably because the ones I was downloading, the ones that were attractive to me, were the ones that were for home screen, not for lock screen. So I finally found a product that will let me put, that will let anybody put a home screen widget onto their lock screen. So if there's a widget you really like in the Google Play Store that you would like on your lock screen, but it's made for the home screen, this app here called Lock Screen Widgets and Drawer will let you do that. So it's a really, really good, it's powerful little widget. It's not free. It's $1.89 or $2.14 after taxes. But it's really worth it if you're struggling with the apps with the widgets that you have on your phone that you don't like maybe, and the ones on your lock screen maybe you don't like them. Then you can have you can download any widget off the Google Play Store and use it on your lock screen if you like. So this is what it looks like when I tap on my phone. So the tap feature is something I have set up in both of my phones. So that this is not a feature necessarily of lock screen widget. It's I have it set up to tap. And what I like about this is that I can see how far along it's coming when it's charging, or I just tap on it in the morning to see if I need to plug it in. And it gives me a nice little app like that. So it's, I don't need my glasses anymore because God knows the little indicator in the top right is very small. And I don't really always want to pick up my phone and put my glasses on. So this is really nice because I just sit in my lazy boy. I reach over, I tap on the phone, and I can see what the progress is. You can also have a clock. I also put, you can have more than one widget with this app. You can put more than one widget. You just add rows and columns in the settings, And I added a weather app. And the problem with the weather app, of course, is that it was static because I don't have my phone set up for dynamic lock screen. But you can do that. I don't want that because I don't want Wi-Fi. I don't want any my battery being chewed up with Wi-Fi being used up for weather updates. So if I just want to check the weather, I just open my phone and tap on my weather icon. So I will put in in the chat, I will put in a link to the battery app that I chose with the battery widget, which is also the simplest one I could find, but that looks really good because I tried a number of them. Some were not that attractive, but I was getting desperate and I ended up deleting them all. So this is the one I kept. And I'll also put in, there's a nice article in Computer World on, and I just found this today, and the guy really likes it as well, the article, the author. He wrote about lock screen widget and drawer. And the drawer feature in lock screen widgets is just a drawer for shortcuts. So you can open this drawer on the lock screen or you can open it on home screen. So if you run out of place on your home screen, I have three home screens and two of them are full. And the third one, I actually have an open calculator on there. It's another feature written, another app written by the same guy who wrote this lock screen widget. And it's a calculator that's always on your home screen. It's transparent. It's just a grid with all the functions and the numbers, the digits. And you don't have to open up your calculator app. I just swipe to the third home screen. And then I just put in all my calculations, quick calculations. And so that's my little app. And I'll put in the chat screen, I'll put in links for you to go to read more on it and to look at my, if you're interested in the battery app as well. So that's it.
Okay, so as Linda says, very cool, Bridget. Thanks.
Thanks.
Thanks very much. Okay, our last pre-prepared thing is from Chris.
Yeah, so at our last general meeting last week, we had a really excellent presentation on fraud from a gentleman from the Ottawa Police Service. And so I had actually already prepared a little bit of information on this, and I almost dropped it, and I thought, well, no, probably not a bad idea just as a reminder. So if you think that you're unscammable or you wouldn't fall for these scams where, you know, everybody says, oh, you know, I wouldn't fall for that. They lost $100,000, you know, to a romance scheme or something like that. And you think that you wouldn't fall for such obvious things. Well, maybe, maybe not. Next. Smashing Security is a weekly podcast that's put out by Graham Cluley and Carol Terrio in the UK. And it's actually very, very good information that's on there. I highly recommend it to anybody who's got an hour to kill once a week, or you can run it afterwards and speed up the thing to 1.5 or double speed if you can follow it. Very good information, and it is really specifically about computer security. So they've been doing this for years. You can see down the URL to this one. This was security, Smashing Security podcast number 353 on weekly podcasts. So it's been going on a long time. Next. And Carol, one of the hosts, recently fell for an online scam. And if you go to that podcast, it starts at 18 minutes and 5 seconds into the podcast if you just want to ignore the other stuff. But I think it's a really, really good lesson because this is somebody who is pretty savvy, who thinks about computer security and online security on an ongoing basis, and she fell for a scam where she is still trying to recover some money, you know, that got deducted from her credit card. Next. So I think the bottom line on this is everybody out there who thinks that they're not likely to get scammed, don't be critical of people who do get scammed. First off, it doesn't help the situation at all anyhow. So you're just going to shame them if you're critical to them. You're just going to make other people that you talk about this feel ashamed if they later on get scammed. And we don't want that. We want it that if you get scammed, you know, do something about it. Do whatever you can about it. Make sure other people are informed and so forth. So it really can help happen to anybody to get scammed online. So if it happens to you, you know, fess up to it. Carol was pretty forward, and that's, I thought it was really good that, you know, on Smashing Security Podcast, she admitted to the fact that she got scammed. And so help people out who do get scammed, and don't be too critical of them or think that they're foolish when something bad happens to them. It might happen to you someday. So that's it.
So what kind of a scam was it, Chris?
It was a website that had a closing out sale, and they had fantastic bargains on, and the site actually looked pretty good and everything like that. But there were some red flags that just after she ordered up a whole bunch of stuff, and there were some red flags that she thought, something doesn't seem quite right. And some of the people who were helping out to look into it afterwards, Graham in particular, he said that he checked out the domain name registration, and this long-running, you know, e-commerce website that had been selling stuff for years, the domain name had been registered like 1 month before. You know, some other things like that. It was basically just people that were claiming to sell stuff at very good prices, and Carol is not going to see her money, and she's not going to see her goods that she ordered.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Chris. Yeah, I'm actually getting a lot of emails, scams coming in recently, giving me project reports and data analysis and all kinds of things, but basically just a link and from people I've never heard of and on projects I'm not working on. So I'm clear that those are scams.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're just about into the last 12. So if anybody has any other questions or comments, now's the time to put something in the chat or open your microphone and just ask us a question.
It's so Bridget, been a rare...
You got an Interact e-transfer scam last week that is on our Fraud Watch page.
So, Chris, what would you say, other than checking the domain name, I guess, I'm not sure how to do that, but what's the best way if you Google an item that you know you're not necessarily going to get on Amazon, so you have to use a smaller e-commerce site and you may have never heard it before, like something specialized? What's your best indicator? What's your best strategy?
It can be really, really difficult, especially if the site in question has been really carefully crafted, and it might actually look pretty good. One of the things I've done quite frequently in the past when I'm on a site that I'm unfamiliar with, I will just Google for, you know, whatever they call themselves and then add scam or something like that after
it. Okay, that's a good idea.
And then if it is a scam, you're probably going to get some hits on some people saying, don't buy from these people, it's all just a scam. And the same thing happens with software. If it's a piece of software you really don't have any clue about, and if you Google for the name of the software and then malware or scam or virus or something like that, if other people have had bad experience with it, it almost certainly is going to show up.
Yeah, that sounds good. Thanks.
But if other people on the call tonight have other ideas, I would love to hear it, because my experience has been difficult. So if other people have ideas of good things to check out, legitimacy of things, pipe in.
Jocelyn has a suggestion here that paying for things using PayPal can be a way to reduce risk, because at least you're not giving out your credit card number.
True, yeah. That's a good idea. I've also heard people that say if you do have a credit card, if you do want to pay through credit card, it's not a bad idea to get another credit card with a very low limit on it. Like if you've got a credit card that's got $10,000 limit on it, although at least in theory, you don't have to pay for anything that is provable fraud. You don't want to have to be fighting for it. So if you have a credit card that has a $200 limit on it or something like that, or whatever you think is the maximum that you're going to want to pay for on sites like this that you are unfamiliar with, then at least you're limiting your exposure that way. So that can help.
I'm just thinking of what I ordered this week because I'm trying 4 bottles of non-alcoholic red wine. It could just be colored water when it arrives. I have no idea. I might be back to the beer.
It could be.
So, Alan, I noticed there was a question in the chat about a notification of my upcoming photo presentation. So if I could just quickly answer that. So these aren't necessarily done on any particular regular basis. So just take the information off that slide because there won't be any email sent out by OPCUG. I just do them to certain seniors residences and seniors group. And I thought they had asked for one on this. So I thought I may as well share it.
And I pasted that into the chat as well again at this point if you just wanted to copy it.
Thanks, Chris.
Okay, so a couple of comments came in. Jeff says, the options MasterCard from Canadian Tire will issue a card with the lowest limit I could find, $300. And it's linked to PayPal, his PayPal account, so he has double protection. And Tom notes that PayPal, I think he means PayPal and credit cards, can give refunds if you're cheated.
Yeah, credit cards, I think you're supposed to be limited to, I forget what it is, $75 or $50 liability if it is out-and-out fraud. But the trouble with that sometimes, if you end up with, well, if Linda gets her bottles of pure water rather than wine, then that might be hard to get a refund on because typically the credit card will say, well, you have to go back to the merchant and complain to them. Well, if it's a fraudulent type thing like that, you're not going to have any success going through the merchant. And so, yeah, you could be fighting for months, you know, trying to get your money returned on this.
Testing, 1, 2, 3, testing.
It won't be fraudulent, Chris, because it is low alcohol.
That's true.
So Linda has raised her hand. Go ahead, Linda.
No, it was...
it's Lorraine.
Lorraine.
Is it okay if I change the subject and just ask a question?
Sure. Yes, yeah, absolutely.
Okay, well, it's about my old friend again, the one who is 78 years old and is afraid of computers. Well, her computer finally died, so I directed her towards a Chromebook. Did I do a good thing there? She just wants to do email and do searches on Google, and that's it.
Personally, I think so. I think Chromebooks are fine. They are typically less expensive than Windows laptop would be. It is more functional than a tablet in that you get a keyboard and a trackpad. You can easily add a mouse to it as well. So personally, I think for anybody who doesn't need to run, you know, Windows apps, like, you know, I need it for a Windows computer for a lot of the applications I run. They only run under Windows. But if all you need is email and you're using web browsing to get there, and you're doing a little bit of searching and, you know, things like that on the web, I think Chromebook is a really good solution.
Okay, thank you very much.
I see Harvey Hopepad is thumbs up on that one as well. So Harvey supports all kinds of people. Harvey, have you had any horror stories to share with people that got a Chromebook and just said, oh, no, it doesn't do what I want?
No, but I get a few elderly clients, of course, that have a lot of difficulty understanding a computer and what it is. One lady called me up yesterday. She was in a fit because her computer said, I need a Windows update. And she says, I thought it was up to date. Can you look at this? I says, well, what Windows do you have now? She says, well, I think it's Windows 7. Well, she was so stressed out. I said, how about I come over and talk to you about it? And when I went there, I found out that she had an up-to-date Windows 11 on a one-year-old computer. So he just did not have sufficient knowledge. He had just barely enough to get by. And to top it off, as an example, I said, you know, you can do an e-transfer to me. She said, okay. And when that came through, it was a request for payment from me. I phoned and left a nice message, and I said, Linda, I got this request for payment, but I have to get you to send me the money. So that came in about a half an hour later. But as you can probably read through your mind in this story, I say to some of my people, I know some people should not have a computer. I'm not making fun of them. I'm just saying that they need that guidance, you know, something and somehow to get them to learn a little bit better. I've always suggested check with the library just to see what's available. But everybody doesn't need or doesn't want to do that. Anyway.
I have another question, and on that, if you don't mind me asking. She wants to go and buy that from Staples. I mean, do you think Staples will give them the support that she needs? Because she's not knowledgeable at all on computers.
Let me put it into a few words. They're just so happy to sell anybody junk, okay? You need to go to a reputable person. I'm going to put my hand up here. And help guide them to what it is that they should be using. As I say, some clients, they'll go in, they get sold anything and everything. Unfortunately, that's the way of life, I guess.
But Lorraine, if you're guiding her, that's half the battle. So yeah. I think you're on the right track.
Yeah, but I'm in Waterloo and she's in Ottawa. So, yeah, okay. So
you can look at what's online, and you know they will have everything listed on their website, so you can look through and make sure that she doesn't overbuy or underbuy. You know, so you could look at the really low end. You know, if she's trying to buy something that's $250, you know, you might look at it and say, well, it looks like it's probably a little underpowered. Maybe go a little bit higher. On the other hand, if she's looking at something that is $1,000 for a Chromebook, no, you don't need that good of Chromebook.
Oh, okay.
I was just going to say, Chris, don't forget, an excellent source for computers, et cetera, is the Trailing Edge.
That's true, too.
They provide exceptional equipment. One of my clients has bought 3 computers last month, so we're getting him set up, but they all run just great. They're all business class computers. They're not the so-called commercial type that you would get at, you know, Best Buy or Staples.
Yeah.
So Bob Dunn makes a note.
What did you call it? Sorry. What did you call it? I didn't get. Do you want to put it in the chat?
I'll put it in the chat for you. Okay.
Thanks.
Yeah, it's the Trailing Edge. They've given a couple of presentations to the group, and they're certainly very trustworthy. They are here in town, so if you're dealing with something that, you could potentially purchase it and ship it. Or have them ship it potentially as well. But yeah, they're definitely a very trustworthy organization.
Trailing Edge. Okay.
Trailing Edge, yeah.
Okay, got you now.
Excuse me. A terrific reference if someone is shopping for a Chromebook is Google's own support page that tells you when each specific model has its end of life date. So if you see a Chromebook that's on sale for $200, it's the most wonderful, greatest thing you ever see. And you go to Google support page and you see it's got 2 months of support left. You know why it's on sale. But there's plenty of great computers at only a couple $100. I was looking in the Staples flyer today. They had a Lenovo Duet 3. And I had a quick look at Google's support page, and it's supported until mid-2031.
I just pasted into the chat the Google page on support life for all the different manufacturers' Chromebooks.
Yeah. So this way you can nail down exactly when Google stops supporting it and you're sailing the pirate seas on your own.
Yeah. Bob Garrett made the same comment that the downside of Chromebooks is a short lifetime. But that's common for all Android systems right now. I found it really interesting that Google have a white paper out on supporting right to repair. They should support right to maintain or right to extend end of life or something.
Yeah, on perfectly capable, good working hardware.
Precisely, yeah.
You can also download Chrome OS to run on almost any PC, and PCs are getting faster and smaller these days. You can get mini PCs for $100 that will run Chrome OS and add a monitor and a keyboard and a mouse, and you're off to the races.
Well, you can download Linux and have unlimited end of life support.
That's true.
Simple computers, Alan.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I've been thinking. I have Windows 95 on my Lenovo, ThinkPad Butterfly PC. I really should download Linux on it because, I mean, it's only got 48 megabytes of RAM and it's kind of limited, but... I think Linux, some editions of Linux can actually run on such small, limited old PCs. I mean, it's, almost 20 years old now.
If it won't, you can always run DOS.
Sorry, 30 years old.
Okay, we've hit the magic witching hour, so let me just wrap up by saying here's Linda's Armchair Travel presentation slide. So that will be on the web. That's coming up on the 23rd, but before that, no, actually not before that, after that, immediately after that, January 24th will be next Wednesday. So Linda's is next Tuesday, and next Wednesday will be our next Q&A session. So if you've enjoyed the talks tonight and you want more of the same, let us know what you need to know about. Send us questions, send us shares. We'll be happy to include them in next week's deck. But apart from that, that's everything from me. Hope you enjoyed tonight, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks, folks. We'll see you then.